Hi, this is Ken Tangen. This is episode 9 of What's It Like. My guest is Brad Hill. Brad and I were psych majors together in college. But Brad took a different path. He became the Reverend Dr. Brad Hill, serving as both missionary and pastor.
Well, those include the two big sections of my life. We were missionaries in the Congo for 19 years and doing a variety of things. And since then, we came back. The last 20 years, I've been serving in different capacities as pastor or as interim pastor in the Evangelical Covenant Church. Other than that, I could name lots of busy things I do. I write and read and so on, but those are the two big pieces of life, yes.
I'm more than a bit ignorant when it comes to denominations, so tell me something about the Evangelical Covenant Church.
Yeah, it's relatively small, but, you know, if I can brag for a moment, it's one of the few that have grown every year in the last 20 years. And in America, that's saying something these days. Yeah, it has Lutheran roots. It came out of the Swedish Pietist Renewal Movement in the 1800s. And so came to America with the Swedish immigration. Since then, of course, it's evolved to a very multicultural church. In fact, most of our growth in the last 20 years has come from church plants amongst ethnic groups, Vietnamese or Korean or Hmong or a variety of others. So we're really glad to see that as part of our changing identity. We could call ourselves evangelical, but not fundamentalist. We go through a whole list of things. We're very biblical, but not doctrinaire, I would say. Hold to the fundamentals of the faith, but we're non-creedal. I mean, I can play back and forth between that. So we're basically what we want to do is find the commonalities in orthodoxy and build on that and build partnerships and together, you know, work and build the kingdom of God.
So you're wacko, but not crazy?
No, we're not even wacko.
Oh, okay. more mainstream.
Yeah, well, mainstream in some ways, but there certainly is that important evangelical center to it where we believe that people need the Lord and have a personal relationship with Him, but that should result and must necessarily result in being a disciple, which then carries you further into the area of being as Jesus in this world in terms of the works that you do and the witness that you carry.
Did you grow up with this philosophy or religious background?
Well, I would say so. My folks joined the Covenant Church when I was just a few years old, and I'm an only child, and, you know, so I got the advantage of their undivided attention, and they were very committed Christians themselves. When I was about 10 or so, I went to a Bible camp and made the profession of faith and also committed myself to missions at that point, not really knowing what that was about, but that was the initial commitment. I'd say that my childhood, of course, has everything to do with who I am now. It was a very stable, you know, growing up, characterized by a lot of love and acceptance, but they had high expectations for me, but weren't driving me.
What part of the world did you grow up in?
Seattle.
Oh.
South Seattle.
South Seattle.
Yep. Yeah.
How south of Seattle were you?
About midway between Seattle and Tacoma, area called Des Moines.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's not Seattle. I grew up in South Seattle, White Center, which is just the edge
West Seattle. Come on, kid.
Yes. Yeah, so you're actually closer to for geography purposes, closer to SeaTac Airport.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. But I usually just say Seattle because not everybody knows about all that.
It's
fine tuning, right? Yeah.
So as you were growing up, your parents impacted your beliefs by taking you to church. But what else did they do in terms of kind of giving you a sense of yourself or your life?
Well, I would say that they were models of sort of faithfulness and consistency that I saw in them, a steadiness. They, you know, that characterizes what everything they did, whether it was the jobs they were doing or their marriage relationship or the church that they attended. I saw when commitments were made, you carried them through, and I saw in their lives a dignity and a care and a love that, and maybe at that time I couldn't identify all the sources of that, but that certainly became in many ways my model and influence who I aspired to be anyway.
You said your parents. Go ahead.
Go ahead. No. I can just keep talking, so interrupt anytime you want.
You said your parents encouraged you to do well.
Yes.
Did you have any particular challenges in school?
I was just an average student early on. I seemed to get better the longer I was in school, actually. But, you know, I was a B and C student most up through junior high, and did a little better in high school and better in college and then better in grad school and really great in doctoral studies. So I quit just when I hit my peak.
Yes. Well, I think that's the key. It actually is kind of easier the farther you go.
I think because you find those areas that are really invigorating rather than just you endure it.
Yes, because you've now picked an area and you're getting more and more specialized in those things.
Yeah, I think that's it. But Dad was an Eagle Scout, you know, and so he had all these aspirations, and an electrician, and he's one of these guys that could build anything and do anything and fix anything and probably not even need the plans, you know. So he's always encouraging me to do that, and I won't say that I was a disappointment in that area, not really at all, but I think he realized finally that I did not have the gift. And so, you know, encouraged me basically to be whoever I needed to be.
Did you become an Eagle Scout?
No, I never went to Scouts. I did a lot of camping with him, though.
So you let him be your Scout leader, huh?
Yeah. And Mom, I think she was a very joyful, sort of adventuresome person. I think Dad was maybe not quite as out there and, you know, gregarious as Mom was, but she was took all the initiative in the family stuff and led in family things and was a deaconess in the church and the secretary. And she lived out her faith, too. So really between these two, they were really sort of setting the direction, if not the channel, that I would later follow.
Did you have a particular, is there a path that you thought you would follow but didn't?
Yeah, I think so. When I went to college, as you may recall, I was a psych major.
Yes.
Yeah. And
we sat in many classes together.
Yeah. Clinical counseling seemed to be an appeal to me at that point. I ended up in the getting a double major in education. So educational psychology began to have an appeal. And I thought, but it was about that time I had this renewal of this call to be a missionary. And the focus then was on Congo. And I was dating a young woman named Ruth, who I later married, who was also pursuing sort of her calling and career in life. And she felt the Lord's hand on her, too, to lead her into missions. And so, hey, we might as well get married and go together, you know. So I never really ended up in that field, though, you know, there's nothing ever wasted. And certainly psychology and education has been done well for me over the years.
Well, many of us thought that we were going to save the world with psychology.
Yeah, I think now we're just trying to repair it. We're not trying to save it, right?
Or survive it.
Yeah. We're more into remedial action, maybe.
That's it.
So I'm still trying to save it, so.
How did you come to, you said you had a calling to become a missionary.
Yeah, okay. I didn't go a lot into that, but I can go back and give you more on that if you want.
Yeah, well, I mean, what's that like?
Well, I think for me, is the only way I can describe it, is that I described the initial encounter when I was 10. I just felt there was a speaker there who was from Congo, and every day there felt like more resonance with my soul. This is me looking back now. I probably wouldn't have said it that way when I was 10. But there was an appeal and a resonance, and I began to think more about it, and I went and talked to him, and we prayed about it, and I it was just a conviction at that point. I can't draw a straight line from there to like going to Congo, but you know, it's sort of one of those zigzag lines. during my first, second year of college, though, I was cast into sort of a seeking search mode. You remember, it was the Vietnam era, and I enlisted in the Marines and all that stuff, and had a motorcycle accident, and so they discharged me, and life was sort of in a disarray at that point. And it's sort of at the bottom of that depression, there was sort of a, what do I call it, a existential sort of moment where I was alone in the dark on my bed and felt before my feet was this abyss, and you know, I either needed to sort of jump off into these philosophies I was dabbling with or come back to the Lord. And he reminded me at that point of my commitment and my calling to missions, and there was a sense of a renewal in my life and a new experience with the Holy Spirit. And that whole walk down the aisle when I was 10 came back in almost a visionary experience. Mm. I don't really find a lot of people to talk about their call in that way. I can talk about it in terms of an alignment of maybe personality characteristics and possibilities and need in the world as well. Those things came together, I think, as well.
But it's pretty much an experience for you.
No, it was an experience, sure. But I would say it's an experience and confirmed by a lot of things. Because once I recommitted to that call, a lot of things lined up, including a wife that wanted to go. as I said, I ended up in education, but that was not by intent. I was taking education courses because I had finished all of my psych courses. And there was a guy that came into our class saying, we're looking for people to do an experimental ed program. If you've pretty well finished your degree in psychology and you want to get a degree in education, and there were like four of us, myself and my wife and a couple others, and they paid for our whole senior year tuition to do this program with them, and that enabled us to get married. I mean, there's a wow. recounting of a lot of things that once the commitment was made, especially in retrospect, you look back and say that the Lord lined up to make that path possible.
Feels like everything dovetailed together.
All the significant things. It's not as if there were no obstacles to overcome. Yeah, but certainly.
That's one of the challenges of life, isn't it? Is to decide whether this is something you push through or something that you have to pull back and wait for.
Yeah, I think about it in terms of, I think the Lord needs to open certain doors, but then there's doors I need to kick down. Mm-hmm. And you're right.
How do you tell the difference?
Well, if I kick hard enough and I break my foot, there's probably nothing where I'm going to kick down.
So push.
It's a process of elimination.
I see. Push until it's time to wait.
Well, it could be. But if you've, you know, if you've gone through three or four doors and it really seems to be the way to go, and then there's some obstacles, it's not as if there's anything in the promise of God or in the call of God that says, you know, you're just along for the ride.
Yeah.
You know, you're an active participant.
You mentioned Ruth.
Yeah.
Who is a delight.
Yeah.
In fact, she is such a delight. You know, I could have easily fallen in love with her myself.
I was wondering about that. I got there first is all.
That's it. What's it like to fall in love?
It's just a warm feeling of honey going down. No. You know, I don't think that we fell in love so much as love grew. Mm-hmm. You know, our first meetings and our first dates were fun and good, and we enjoyed each other's company. And
not magical.
No, I think magic... There have been many magic moments, but I think love is just something that grew over time, basically. It's like at some point I became aware that I loved her, but it wasn't like this moment where I said, gosh, I fell in love. I had been slowly falling in love you know, for a couple of years almost, and then at some point you wake up and realize it. I think she woke up and realized it long before I did. Hanging in there.
Well, I always thought she was smarter.
Well, there's no doubt about that.
As you... Oh, I had a thought, but it disappeared. As happens to me all the time.
Yeah, I think you'd stop... during the missionary career time, I went out as a high school teacher and taught in an African high school. But while I was there, felt like the next step of the call was developing, and that was into pastoral ministry. So during furloughs, every furlough came back and did more studies. So my Master Divinity degree was spread out over like 6 or 7 years.
Oh.
And the Doctor of Missiology, I think, was spread out over 4 years, because I could never get it all done in one block.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so as a result of that, I was able to move from teaching in the high schools to actually teaching in the seminaries in Congo, doing pastoral training with African pastors.
Rather than a medical missionary, you were an educational missionary.
Yeah, well, certainly.
But that provides you with practical help as well as spiritual.
Yeah, yeah. Now, those experiences, though, it seems like there's a big divide between being a missionary pastor, professor, to now coming to the United States and being a pastor of a American church.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, there is a big divide, but it's still a lot of the same skills as, you know, learning the Word of God, being able to teach it and to apply it. But I think maybe one difference that I have is I tend to look at everything around me sort of through a cross-cultural grid now, and I even interpret my own society as an anthropologist. I'm sort of this participant observer on the outside looking in and yet also a part, which can drive some people nuts at times.
But your experience in the Congo gives you a different perspective when you come back here?
Yeah, yeah, I think so, because my cultural assumptions of the West are not necessarily my own. And if they are, I've tried to become more aware of them over time.
Mm-hmm.
So nothing like living in another culture for all those years to highlight who you are and what your actual cultural identity is.
Yes.
Yeah.
My parents were missionaries to China.
Mm-hmm.
And
recall that.
And I remember growing up thinking of myself as being an international person.
Yeah.
Even though I didn't travel internationally, mm-hmm. The mindset was still don't look so much at the culture that you're in, but see yourself as part of the world.
Right.
Did you like the process of becoming a doctor of ministry?
Yeah. I loved studies. I could just stay in seminary forever, but sooner or later I had to go out and do stuff. But getting the title doctor, I don't know if that was as important, but once in a while it comes in handy. I was asked to teach a course at North Park Seminary, mostly because at the last minute the professor was sick and couldn't do it, and they were looking around for some local missionary, and because I had the DR in front of my name, I was able to do that. I mean, so it does help in some places.
Yes. And people at hospitals will pay more attention to you if you introduce yourself as doctor.
Yeah, but then they might call me on a cold blue.
Well, that's the downside.
Yes. And then I will pray for you as you operate. Yeah.
I have limits, but, you know, I'll do what I can.
Yeah.
What's the best thing about your job?
Well, my current job over the last about 4 years now, I've been what they call an intentional interim pastor. I come into churches that are in crisis or between called pastors or are declining or dying. There's a variety of reasons why they might call me now. And I actually got more training in this area through another school.
In your denomination, are the pastors selected by the local churches?
Yes, they are.
So they're voted on?
It's in cooperation with the denomination that they work together for that. Yeah, I served two long-term pastorates of 8 years and 7 years, but recently I've been doing these from 1 to 2 years interims. The goal differs depending on the church. For one church, it was really just to help them close. And for another church, is that they had gone through a pastoral trauma with immorality on the pastor's end and so on, and the church was in complete disarray. You know, and so I have no illusions about being, you know, the one to the rescue. Here I come to save the day, but often they just need a stable presence and somebody that is at least perceived as fairly non-anxious and unflappable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so I bridge that gap for a while and help get stuff settled and a new vision cast for the church and a new pastor is called.
So you may not save them, but at least you will do no harm.
Well, that's my first rule of thumb, is do as little harm as possible. Yeah. Anyway, it involves a lot of counseling, conflict resolution stuff, maybe leading in the arts of forgiveness and repentance and helping the church discern a new vision for itself. And, so all that's connected to everything that's come before. So what I'm doing now is sort of the tip of the iceberg of everything that has been part of my life till now. Mm-hmm. It's a convergence of a lot of things.
What has surprised you about the process?
Well, that I'm here at all, I think. That I didn't set out to be a pastor, and yet here I am. I didn't set out to be an intentional interim, yet here I am. Mm-hmm. It's nothing that I set as a goal early on, and yet, as I look back, it would have been a worthy goal, but it wasn't mine. The warmth and the care and the love and the vitality that you can find even in the smallest dying church is still full of wonderfully warm, caring, good people. A lot of things come together to, bring a church to its conclusion, but still I've enjoyed each church and the people that I've met there and feel blessed by having been there.
We'll have more with the Dr. Reverend Brad Hill right after this reminder. It's just a nudge to remember the good work being done by the American Red Cross. It's time to put something on your to-do list. It's something you should do. Go to redcross.org. They're doing good work and they need your help. Click on Giving and Get Involved and donate something to the cause. Somewhere in the world today, there are people you can help through the Red Cross. And don't forget to get prepared yourself for emergency situations. Go to their store and check out the Personal Safety Emergency Pack. Do yourself a favor. Give to the American Red Cross. Go to redcross.org. We're back with Dr. Brad Hill. So, Doc, you got any hobbies?
Yeah, I've got maybe four hobbies. Reading. I read lots. And
are you a Kindle fan?
I do have a Kindle. Just got one this year for my birthday. That's wonderful.
But you also read old-fashioned paper?
Yeah, I could turn my Skype around here and show you all the books around here, but when I'm not doing serious study, I like Vince Flynn and some adventure spy type stuff.
Ah.
Yeah, I do a fair amount of writing. I get a lot of articles, and a couple of books have come out, and I'm a runner, and a couple of years ago took up scuba.
You run a lot, don't you?
I am not as much as I used to. A variety of injuries and stresses over the years have made me not as stupid.
Have you always been a runner?
Ever since high school.
Yeah.
In fact, if you go to a website called manybooks.net and put my name in, Brad Hill, you will find a book there called Runner Man. And it's a autobiography of my running career, salted with gratuitous advice for people that probably don't care about.
What could be better?
Yes. Now I do about 5, 6, 7 miles every other day, but not with a lot of fast pace and a lot on grass if I can.
When you were in high school, were you on track?
Track. I was a miler.
A miler.
Yeah, I guess I had to put that in quotes, and that's why I wrote this book. It was so traumatic for me that it has affected me in just about every way.
Well, you were a long-distance runner.
Yeah, and the mile turned out to be a little too short for me, so I've been doing long stuff since then. A couple of few marathons along the way, but now I'm basically a 10K guy.
Yeah, that's your favorite frame, this 10K?
Yep, not too long, not too short.
Yeah. I drive 10K.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's probably drive faster than I run it.
Well, I don't know. I'm a pretty slow driver.
Yeah.
Let me ask you about self-motivation. How do you give yourself a kick in the pants? What works for you?
Sometimes it's panic because I know that I have deadlines. But other than that, I'm also convinced that self-starting and that sort of thing has a little bit to do with personality and not just... But I would say that overall, it has to do with a compelling vision for your life, that if you have something that you're passionate about and care about and you're eager to get going on it, don't want to waste time, and so the vision itself becomes sort of the motivator.
So if your vision gets you going, how do you calm yourself down in times of trouble?
Well, that's a good point. If your part of your vision has to do with, you know, building the kingdom of God, when do you go home? You know,
it's like, yes.
It's also a realization, I think, of your finiteness and the limitations that you have, that no matter how hard you work or how quick or how well or how smart or diligently, that there's always an infinite left to do. So it, in a sense, you can quit any time.
Yeah, well, I guess that's true. I guess if you feel that that you're doing God's work, then he's probably more responsible for it than you are.
Yeah, I would certainly say that. It's his created world and his redemption, his promise to one day redeem the cosmos, and I'm just a small part of it. And I am not to think that I am any larger part than I am.
So if you were giving high school graduation advice, what would that be?
Like if I were a commencement speaker?
Yes, is it.
Well, be all you can be. Live your dream. Oh, wait. I've heard that at every commencement, every Oscar, every Academy Awards. That's always the speech, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah. So I won't give that one. And I don't really believe it necessarily. Yeah. Well, if to your audience, I don't know. I would say things like faith and allegiance in Jesus Christ gives meaning and purpose to life and helps direct our life decisions and shapes who we are and puts our work in sort of an eternal perspective of some sort. And
well, that's the preacher in you.
Yeah. Well, you asked for it. And it even, there's a byproduct of joy and peace, at least at times.
And what would you say to the non-believers in my group, which is probably the majority?
I would say that there's an importance to be committed to a community of some sort. For me, it's church, but if you're not a believer, I would invite you to church. But if it's not, I think committed to community is key to self-development.
Hmm.
Where else do you learn what it means to care for one another? And if you think about it in terms of every virtue requires a context of community, where else can you demonstrate patience unless it's intentioned with something? Demonstrate courage if there's not a place that puts you at risk and so on. Every virtue, I think, if you're going to love, you have to be in context with the unlovable. And so you're not going to develop virtue alone. So community itself is critical to self-development. So that certainly would be their audience aspires for themselves. So that certainly would be key. And I would say, you see, I've come to see things more in terms of process and evolution and journey over time instead of sort of black and white or categorical or status or state. And, you know, because that's really more of a description of how we experience life. And maybe as a result of that, I think I've come to the conclusion to don't get stuck on some early appraisal of what your gifts and talents are, because if you do, you're never going to discover what else you might have or what else you might be able to develop in life. So identify those things and go with those strengths, but at the same time, don't limit yourself to what you've already discovered about yourself, because there's more there, maybe more to come.
Possible to learn.
Yeah.
Last question I got for you is actually to help me do better at this process. Think of a defining moment in your life that we haven't talked about. What question should I have asked that I didn't in order for you to tell that story?
Yeah, well, that's a great catch-all question at the end here to get you off the hook for actually having to think of those things, isn't it?
Thank you.
You must be a psychologist.
Or manipulative old man.
Yeah. Well, I can think of a couple of defining moments. I don't think there's one outstanding defining moment. I don't know, maybe you would have asked something like, is there an event in your life? What is the event in your life that most put you at risk or challenged who you are?
Mm-hmm.
And that could probably draw some interesting comments. And when I think about that, maybe the one who challenged me the most of who I was going up in a dugout canoe with an outboard motor up a river called the Ebola River. Does Ebola ring any bells? Ebola virus?
Yes, it doesn't sound good.
Yeah, so this is exactly where that was. But that's not the point of the story. 100 some miles up this river, we came to a village that we were attending, that we were trying to get to. And just about, I would say, half to two-thirds of the children in that village had died of measles. And I remember some had been buried and some had not yet. And I remember sort of walking through that village with some of the village elders and hearing the laments of the parents and just thinking about what all that implied. Measles is so easily contained, you know, and dealt with, and yet they had no access. How they got it in the first place, because it's not natural to the tribal African, you know, it's an imported disease. Mm-hmm. And what my role there is now as pastor who is supposed to bring a message of hope. And it was so hopeless there. I mean, all of those questions were fundamental questions that shake you and make you ask those things of yourself. Maybe I have nothing. Maybe I am nothing. And to think more about your role in life and what you may or may not actually have to offer.
And what brought you out the other side?
Well, I'm not sure I ever came out the other side, Ken. I don't think that, here's the answers to that, and I've emerged. But if what you mean is, how come I just didn't run off screaming into the heart of darkness? It still comes back to those fundamentals, I think, that are part of who I am and what I have been given. I understand maybe more appreciably what the grace of God is about. I understand maybe the tighter relationship between issues of compassion, mercy, and justice on this earth and what it means to be a follower of Christ. And that I was there because God brought me there. And so I was able to speak to and minister to a number of people there. And there is a church in that village now, not directly as a result of that, but as part of that. And so I see all of that as at least partial responses to why there is evil and tragedy in this world, and if not complete answers. And I hope to be part of that answer anyway.
And it's a growth from in thought. So it becomes a realization that bad things can happen to good people. That because bad things happen to you doesn't mean that you've done anything wrong.
Though it may.
Yes. Know. But the villagers didn't do anything wrong in order to get measles.
No, I'm never going to connect a one-to-one dot between, you know, illness and tragedy and sin, and yet sometimes those connections do exist. But certainly the whole problem there is more systemic, having to do with the whole social intercourse and how things are related than any one thing you can point to.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then I'm fortunate to say that there's good things that happen to bad people, and that's just as inexplicable.
It's true.
Mm-hmm.
I want to thank Brad Hill for joining me today, and thanks so much. Appreciate the interview.
Yeah, well, it's been a pleasure. And remember, double knot your shoes when you run, and check your scuba apparatus twice before you dive.
All right, well, those are words to live by. Thanks, Brad.
All right, you're welcome.